This is the beginning of class 11.
Sashi Bhagi Jushin Eta Jam Rira Vinshi Nyande Nyampadi Sange Shindu Mithe Uwagi Jogu Nanda Shimba Jubashu Sangye Chodan Sangye Chodanma Chanchu Badu Dagni Kapsuchi Dagi Chunyen Dupe Sunamki Dora Penche Sangye Chupasho Sangye Chodan Sangye Chodanma Chanchu Badu Dami Kapsuchi Dagi Chumyen Dipe Sunamki Jola Penche Sangye Jupasho Sangye Chodan Sangye Chodanma Chanchu Badu Dami Kapsuchi Dahi Chunyen Kipe Sunamki Lola Penche Sangye Jubashu.
First, I'd like you to look at the outline you just
That's a question before.
Yeah.
I was trying to understand the insight of Vipassana meditation. The definition is sort of like, I didn't really get it, you know, the way it was defined. I mean, the definition is that wisdom which is full of exceptional bliss, the practice these by power of the analysis of its object, and which is founded upon quietude. Is that saying once you have quietude, you then focus that quietude upon wisdom, and the result is exceptional bliss?
No. When we debate this subject in the monastery, it's with a different text. And they say, what's the difference between insight and quietude? And the object is the same. They both look at jinyebechu and jitawechu, which means, jinyebechu means everything there is. The things that are. And jitawechu means the way things are. So they both focus on the same object. The things that are and the way things are. And they both have the same essence. They're both
same level of concentration.
They're both tingenzen. They're both shamatha, based on shamatha or shamatha. And then the only difference between them is whether or not they are analyzing the object or not.
So one is analytical.
They're both fixed on the object. They're both a kind of fixation on the object, but vipassana is analyzing the object.
So analytical versus semi-point.
Analytical versus non-analytical. And that's the way they say it.
Would that be like the chokkam and the shogam and the chigam? Would then the chigam be the vipassana and the shogam be... or chokkam is the...
No, it wouldn't be
shamatha.
Like that. It would be... shamatha is the... Yeah, shamatha is like shogam in the sense that it's just the condition of being fixed on the object perfectly. Mm. And having exceptional bliss, which is caused by... that's an interesting thing, and Ariel and I were talking about it today. The way it works is that you get focused on the object perfectly. Therefore, your mind is what we call lesarum, which means fit to do its work perfectly. Based on that, the inner winds, the psychic winds upon which the mind rides, are all put into perfect order. All throughout your body, the inner winds are put into perfect order because your mind is in perfect order. based on that, you start to feel bliss in your body. And because of that, you feel happy and you start to feel bliss mentally. So those are what the bliss means. It means those four steps going on. Because of that, you feel happy and you start to feel bliss mentally. So those are what the bliss means. It means those four steps going on in your body. Your mind starts to concentrate better. Therefore, the winds straighten out. Because the winds are straightened out, you feel bliss. And because you feel bliss physically, you're happy. You feel better mentally. So that's what Dewa Kyabar Chen means, of Shinja. That's what exceptional bliss of practice deeds means.
The difference between both being... I don't understand the difference.
So shamatha is more the fixation on the object, and vipassana is the analysis of the object sitting on the shamatha.
The analysis of the object is still single-pointed concentration from moment to moment of the analysis, right?
Yeah.
And the only difference is, so I'm have single-pointed concentration on the image of the Buddha, and I'm not thinking about anything.
Well,
I'm just seeing.
There's a debate, you know, is this whole Amrim outline, if you go through the whole thing and do a shargo, if you meditate on this outline, which is what I'd like you to do in the next 6 months, I mean, it'd be nice if you got... The point, this is the roadmap to Buddhahood. Mm. And if you know it, it's burned into your mind. You always know where you're at. You always know where you've reached. So can you get single-pointed concentration on these, you know, 11 pages of text? Yes. Is it? What does Sejik mean? What does single-pointed mean? What's the single
focus
point?
Focus on one object.
One object. Single object. The word point is a code word for object. There's nothing single-pointed about it except that it's focused on one object. Is this one object?
Yes.
There was a big debate about it in Tibet. And the Ranglu, our side, says it is. It's a single object. That whole meditation is a single object.
So you're not shifting the object of meditation slightly. It's a move from one section to the other.
You are. So we call it one object. We consider it one object.
Is that the difference between the two? The one you shift from object to object, and the other you stay with one object?
We claim that this is staying with one object.
Then what's the difference between
shamatha
and shamatha?
Oh, shamatha is the state of the meditation, of the concentration.
Well,
shamatha is
okay.
The concentration.
Well, insight.
Vipassana is the analysis based on that concentration. So you can have shamatha towards a worthless object.
I'm trying to understand what analysis means, let me see.
Oh, normally it means the emptiness of the object. But it can also mean the dependent origination of the object.
So it is single-pointed concentration focused on emptiness.
Focused on the nature of a thing.
And its emptiness.
Its positive nature or its negative nature, meaning its dependent origination or its emptiness. Using the tool of shamatha. Okay. And that tool can be used by other people too. Shamatha can be used for other purposes.
So
using this powerful concentration tool, okay. That tool can be used by other people too. Shamatha can be used for other purposes.
So
using this powerful concentration to analyze an object.
So vipassana always incorporates an element of emptiness or dependent origination.
Right.
On
so
whatever
kind of
the
analysis
object is.
Of the way things are or of the things that are. The way things are is a code word for emptiness.
So shamatha is...
The things that are is a code word for dependent origination.
So shamatha is sort of the first step when you take the shamatha and you apply it to the analysis.
There's a big debate about whether you get shamatha first or vipassana first. But if you say that the vipassana is seated on the shamatha, it's based on the shamatha, it's using the shamatha to perceive its object, to concentrate on its object.
Not just the object, but
the shamatha comes first. The ability that... That incredible ability of shamatha comes first. Remember, that's above the ninth level.
Yeah.
Ninth level was kind of okay, very, very close. And based on that ability to concentrate, you focus on the nature of an object.
So
perceive its dependent origination or its emptiness.
So let's see if I understand it correctly. Both are focused on one object. The only difference is that in vipassana, you're perceiving emptiness. Independent or dependent origination in shamatha, you're not.
Yeah.
Okay.
Shamatha. You could be. Yeah. Shamatha is just a tool.
Then it wouldn't be.
Could be focused. It's a microscope. Could be focused on the right thing. In that case, it's vipassana.
Right.
could be focused on a horn, and in that case.
Michael, the way you just spoke about shargong, according to the world position, then shargong is really a subset of jhakgon.
Yeah, you could say that. You could say that. I mean, you could say that. You could say that they don't overlap. That they overlap. But I... Traditionally, both distinctions are made. Okay. This is the way we would do a Lamrim meditation. And I think it's a very appropriate object for your meditation in the morning. I can't, you know, this is the last active class. I can't force you to meditate every morning. I can't refuse to put a 99 on your homework if you don't meditate every morning. I can't check you. You know, all I can say is that if you don't, then the class is a failure, and there's no reason to have had it, really. It's the reason is to give you a lifetime practice, by which, if you keep it up, I guarantee you would gain the ability to concentrate that you require to see emptiness directly. Yeah. And if you don't, you won't, and you will not use this life well. You will die without having used your life well. For what it was meant to be. So I can't do anything now. I can't do anything to force it. But you can do that. You will get that result. It is possible. It's quite coldly possible that you can get exactly that result. And then what else do you need? You know, if you see that you're going to be a Buddha in seven lives or less, if you see your future lives, you know, if you see yourself as a Buddha in the future, then what do you care about? What else happens? What else can tempt you? And you can. You can see it. You can confirm everything you ever heard about Buddhism. You know, that there are Buddhas, that the Nirvana does exist, that you did have a past life in the future. You can see all those things directly. But it's impossible if you don't meditate. And don't think meditation is some thing you're going to do someday in a retreat. Meditation is what you do every morning. And don't think all sentient beings are different than the people around you in your office. That is all sentient beings for you. That's who you have to work with. Based on them, you will achieve Nirvana. Based on them, you will achieve Nirvana. Don't think there's some sentient... All sentient beings is somewhere else, you know. That's where... Those are the ones you're in contact with. Those are the ones you have to work with. And don't think of meditation as, well, someday when I have time, I'll go to a Woodstock up in New York State and in the trees and meditate, you know. It will never come. You know. The meditation has to be done every morning, starting today, tomorrow morning. That's if you don't do it, then there's no meaning for this class. It's been interesting, and you learned a little bit, but there won't be any great result for you.
Michael? Just as far as the method, do you recommend that we go through the entire Lamrim from the beginning, or should we do one section for several weeks and then go to the next step? Or
there's a couple of ways. I would say, for us, there's a way of doing this. There are many books written about your question, and I would say there's a way of doing the Lamrim meditation where you don't go on until you get that Lamrim. Now that can take years.
So you mean that particular verse?
Yeah, say. Until you actually internalize it. Until it actually becomes that. So until you actually see your Lama as a Buddha, you're not allowed to go on. You know, and that could take a long time. So I personally would suggest the other method is that you just keep going. I would like that by the next course, I could sit down and I could read you one of these, and I'd say, what's the next one? And you'd all go,
it's better to go through the sequence than to have depth of each level.
Yeah. My own, what I've found is you take three or four and burn them in during one session for about 3-4 days. You know, get to where you can go 1-2-3-4-4-3-2-1-1-3-5. You know, where you can jump around. That's actually in the Abhidharma a kind of meditation. That is stated in the Abhidharma. It's called belgom. It's called jumping, skip, hop, skip.
You don't mean
Yeah, I mean this.
This.
The English, okay?
1, 2, 3 of these numbers. That's right.
Yeah, you can just say, oh, that's number 5. Avoga said you've got it down when you can walk around in Hasa City and you find a. There were things called satsakangs, which were garbage sheds for holy things. Like if you had a statue and the arm was broken off and you couldn't fix it, you could take it there and it was consecrated land. And so sometimes the wind would blow and pieces of scripture would fly out. And he said he could pick up any one of those that he saw on the road. You know, just a little scrap of paper and say, oh yeah, section 3, number 4, person of medium capacity. You know, that's where you want to be. You want to know the whole roadmap. That's the purpose of studying.
Hey, I'm sorry, but when you think about this, do you think about, let's say, the route of how to take a llama? I mean, do you think all the steps of how to take a llama, or you just think about what are you doing?
You're asking me, do you do shargom or chegom? I'm saying do shargom at the beginning. Do a review where you can do 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. What I'm saying is that the goal for you in the next few weeks, I would say, is to just, I mean, don't try to. Chego, don't try to debate every point with yourself and find its absolute, ultimate truth.
So learn just like memorization.
Learn the outline. You're just burning in the outline. What's burning in Tibetan? Gom. That's the word for meditation. That is meditation. He's been very patient.
I've got two questions. I've heard it said before that you're supposed to seek 12 years to find a lama. Have you ever heard that before?
It comes from...
that would take a long time to get through this.
Especially if you have one right next door and you have to wait for it.
Yeah. It comes from Shanti Deva. Atishak. Who, he took him 12 years to find Serlingba in Indonesia. Something like that. See, that's a true story. It took him that long to get there. He went by ship. And when he got there, he didn't go asking to be his teacher. He spent, I don't know how many months, checking the teacher out before he ever approached him. He went to all his students. He asked, what kind of person is he reliable? What does he teach? What does he know? Because he didn't want to get into that karmic responsibility of treating the teacher correctly before he knew that he was good. So he spent, you know, he risked his life to just wooden boat in 1100 AD from the Indian Peninsula to Indonesia, you know, like a crazy man. And when he got there, he didn't go straight to Serlingba. He waited a long time and checked him out.
So what is the recommendation to us?
My lama always used to say, well, you guys don't have much choice, I'm the only one around. You have to be careful. In New York, I think you get more in-transit lamas than anywhere. So you only see the lama for a few days. I think that's a very delicate situation. You have to try to find out as much as you can about it before you. And you know, when I learned that teaching, then I started to do that in my college. I was still in college, and I used to go to try to find out. It made sense, you know. Maybe I should find out about this professor before I sign up for this course. It was amazing how little they had information about them. You know, you couldn't really find out much about them. And apparently no one ever asked, you know, before they took them. You're exposing your precious mind to this person. You better find out what he's...
Yeah, but Michael, it's not enough that you do the research. You also have to have that connection with the Lama, right? You have to see him as a Buddha. You have to have a sort of, I don't know...
Well, there's obviously some kind of... Yeah.
I guess it's Bell. How do you spell Bell? Sabana.
Sapatapa Dembapela Pel.
Oh, yeah.
You don't have to write this down. This is just.
Is that seven?
That's right.
Okay, so what you can do is if you memorize the English. That is the whole lama. Mm. And that's why it's such an important text. That's why people all over Tibet have always used that text. We always use it before we do our tantric practice. we are required to read it out before that. So if you can, it'd be very good if you could memorize it in the pronunciation, which I didn't put in there. So I'll stick it in, and you guys can memorize that. But inside, that's the shortest thing you can memorize and have the whole Lam Rim in your mind. Right there, anytime you want it.
And so this thing today is to aid in understanding that.
It's not all in. It's not all obvious. Uh-huh. And this comes from Pabokas. This is his outline in his commentary to that book. And I've added a little bit from the Lam Rim Chelmo in places where he didn't go in, like refuge. He didn't go into it. So I in a few sections I added. His outline is the same as the Lam Rim Chelmo, but he doesn't go into all the same details. So it's the same categories that the Lam Rim Chelmo has. By Tsongkhapa. So I just put in certain meditations.
So is your idea that we meditate for the 6 months on the source of all my goodness, Lam Rim, that you gave us, and then this is sort of just footnote reference to expand?
Well, I would say better to meditate, do a Shagom on this outline.
Not the other one. Not the foundational
one. Not the
3.5 page thing.
I'd say both. You see, if you memorize the text, you will see this outline in it.
Right. Mm-hmm.
This is the skeleton of that text. If you strip away the meat, right. You know, this is what's underneath that text. And you will see it once you study this for a while. And I put the text here. It tells you where you're at in the poem, according to Pabokas, and you'll see that that's correct when you compare the verse to the outline. You'll see, oh yeah, this is where I am. So that's a very everything is here. How to get to Nirvana, how to wipe out your kleshas. Everything is in here. Everything is complete in that. So it's a very worthy object on which to develop shamatha.
But I'm still a little curious whether you want us to do anything more than essentially memorize it and understand the way that the points are implied in the poem. So we understand how the structure of the Lam Rim is implied in the poem. Then we have that memorized.
Yeah.
Now, there's, you know, Chagum to the extent that you take each point and debate it to the end. And then there's something that's sort of in between where you kind of, you know, say the point about recognizing all sentient beings as being, having at one point been your mother. But there's something obvious where you can rest in that and try to sort of get a sense of what that being without actually going through a whole analytic breakdown of what that would mean. And so that's sort of in between just memorizing and doing a Chagom.
Yes. What I'm saying is that do a Shagom first. Get the Shagom down first. Just get the outline down in your mind first as an intellectual exercise, as a spiritual exercise. And then you'll be in a position to then go and try to internalize each point. You know, and then you'll find that you can set yourself a daily practice. You pick one of the items from the outline that you're weak on, and you say, okay, I think I'll work on that one for this week, or this 2 weeks, or this month. I find it good to change it every 3-4 months. You know, pick one of those and work on it. But first, I suggest that you just memorize the whole thing. You just get it all down in your mind. If you die without your mind, it's very useful. Okay, very, very good seed in your mind. So just, I think when it was one of Adisha's students said, I would rather get this outline in my mind than develop the ability to fly or to walk on water. You know, he made a whole list of miraculous powers. He understood that it was better if he had this roadmap in his mind. So I think at the beginning, just get the outline down. Then obviously, as you know, that's in the morning. And you can definitely pick one for the day's battle. You know? And then I personally find it very important to record the progress at night. You know, I keep just a few lines of how I messed up and what I did right.
You know,
my mind is down, I use what I did right. My mind is up too high, I use what I did wrong. But I find it very useful to keep a diary of my failures during the day. And then you just doing that makes you tend to improve yourself. Helma, you had a question?
So you're saying that we memorize this outline and not the verse?
Both.
Both. Because this sort of doesn't have the meat that the verse has.
No, it doesn't. The verse These are the bones. These are the skeletons. The meat is the verses.
This is a long meditation, man. Not a 15-minute jaunt.
This is what the monks do. This is the real outline. This is the real outline to the long man.
Outline?
This is what a monk will memorize.
That's the skeleton?
Yeah. You know, this is like, I don't know how many pages.
What's the adult skeleton?
This is 25 pages of small print. And that's what a monk would, he would memorize the whole. This is all the details that aren't filled in there. But you'll find every part there in here, in the same words. That's the bones.
My problem is I've still got a whole portion of the lumps and lumps in my head, and it keeps colliding.
I understand that, yeah. They're, in the end, they're the same thing. And you'll see that as you go. I understand that. So I'd like to go show you the... It's page 9, I think. Page 10. We didn't cover the last few verses of the text. And I'm talking about how to practice this secret teaching. So I can go over the content of the text to you. That's all I can do. I can't explain it much in detail. But you must have this background. Once you have tonight's subject headings in your mind, you are eligible to take an initiation. To take that, if Rinpoche agrees to give it to you personally. But you have legally the training that you're required to have from this course. So then you would be eligible to...
Michael, didn't you say you were going to talk about what it meant to take the initiation?
What I'm going to do right now.
Okay.
So, we're talking about this very last stage here. It says, entering the diamond path, once you have made your mind a worthy vessel, and have taken the four empowerments in a pure form. So entering the diamond path is a word for tantra. Once you have made your mind a worthy vessel, and in the root text, it's tumon lamjan nu de gyurpana, means how do you make your mind worthy? How do you become eligible to have this thing poured into your mind? Is by studying the lamrim and practicing the lamrim. All those stages before here, okay? All those steps before this point that are in the outline, if you know them fairly well, minimum, if you've practiced them somewhat, or even mastered some of them, this just being aware of them, having a good understanding of them, is minimum for permission to even get an initiation, to even get an empowerment. You have to be pretty familiar with everything in the long minute, in this outline.
Empowerment means initiation?
I'll talk to you about it. Okay. So
what
once you
have diamond path again?
Diamond path means the way of tantra. It's called diamond. Vajrayana. Vajra means diamond. Once you have made your mind a worthy vessel, which means you're not allowed to, a lama is not allowed to give you that empowerment, or you can call it initiation, unless you have studied fairly well the lama.
I was told that one of the reasons why lamas are traveling around giving so many initiations is because that if someone requests initiation, they can't refuse without breaking their vows.
Oh, not at all. No. If a teacher gives an initiation to a student who's not ready, it's an automatic ticket to hell for the teacher. And if the student fails to practice properly, then the student gets an automatic ticket to hell. So it's very dangerous. It's very serious on each one's side.
Is the student not practicing also contribute to the teachers going to hell?
If he didn't do enough to attempt to determine whether the student was ready or not, a worthy vessel, you know, if he didn't do enough to determine that the student was well-trained before he got the initiation,
So why are all these high lamas going around giving initiations to strangers?
It's like, okay. And if you don't do it, you feel like you're disrespecting. It's like everybody's expecting you to go up there and just offer a kata.
We talked about it many times. You have to be careful what you...
Yeah, but you say you want to talk about it.
Well, I'm telling you now.
No, but how do you avoid it? I mean, you just sit there.
You don't have to take it. You can take it as a blessing.
Apply a little willpower.
I think you have, you know, Ati Shah took many years to check the teacher out before he walked into that teacher's room. So I think you have to, it's a very serious thing. What is it so serious? It's not so serious. I mean, I think the worst thing that could happen is nothing. And I'm afraid that's what happens most of the time. And so people just begin to think that these things are lightweight. And they don't work. And they go on living their usual life. And I think that was the greatest crime of all. If you had a chance to take one and follow it and reach a high level, and then because you didn't know what to do, it didn't work, and then you began to think in the back of your mind, in the back of your heart, which is evidenced by your failure to practice them every day, you just think they don't work. Or they didn't work very well. Yeah.
Michael, wouldn't it take a certain amount of time to... I mean, I don't want to get into all the specifics of it, but, you know, it doesn't take a certain amount of time. It's such an alien concept to our way of thinking that how can you know if you're practicing well or if you're practicing well enough or, you know, I would think there's got to be a certain grace period of just getting your mind into it to, you know, it's a gradual thing. It's just like, you know, thinking about the concept of emptiness. I mean, as every year goes by, you're going to get more. I mean, I know in the 2 years I've been studying, my concept of it is much more solid now, you know, than it was. As solid as I felt it was in the beginning, you know, and karma and all this, it should be gradual. You can't think that you're going to go straight into it and be, you know, sometimes when you talk about it, it's like, you know, what is practicing well, what is not practicing well, what is getting there, what is, you know, it's confusing. It's a little.
Yeah, but there's this initial period where, like in the meditation, you think you're getting worse because you're just noticing what was going on all along. And after that, Geshe Dorje used to say, and I think it's a good observation, that you should be getting happier. If you have any kind of minimum practice going on, you should be finding yourself more contented, more happy. And if you're not, then I'd say you're not. You don't have to say that you have to practice like a fanatic, because it doesn't make people happy often. But you're getting the essence of, like, caring for other people. And that can make you happy almost immediately. I think if you start practicing any kind of concern or compassion for the people around you, where? At work, on the subway, in the bus station.
Well, the preliminary to that is just thinking about what it is that you're doing every day and, you know, developing compassion, but at least, like we said last time, monitoring, you know, at least then the awareness of, like you said, if it gets bad at first, it's because you're finally making yourself aware of all the thoughts that go on in your mind. And then when something negative comes in your mind, you immediately try to, you know, dispel it or whatnot. So, I mean, that's a beginning stage, but it's gradual. So it must be the same thing with
I think that. It is gradual, but I think the experience of trying to be concerned about others and caring about others more than yourself or just attempting it has some pretty quick effects. That's what I'm trying to say.
If you can do that right away, naturally. You know what I mean? I think that's something you've got to... That doesn't come...
But it's not hard to try. You know, just make a tea for somebody.
Yeah,
no,
of course.
Those are actually the roots of your... That's how it will start. It's not like you're going to cut your finger off for somebody the first day. You know? Shanti Deva says, start with vegetables. Work up to your arm. But he says it's very bad to cut your arm off if you have the vegetables. You should be giving them asparagus. Yeah.
Well, I mean, it requires a certain amount of a bad mind to begin with. This stuff was not developed for perfect beings. It was developed for imperfect beings who wanted to go there, right? So I think it requires a sort of a minimum commitment in the beginning to stick with it and to have faith and to apply the best of your abilities at that time and then to increase them gradually as it goes on.
Yeah.
People shouldn't get the idea that it's so difficult that
That's just it. I mean, a lot
it's not
going
to work and you have to go right into it.
In my mind, sometimes I can't be as joyous as I can be practical sometimes because the joy is like, well, I don't know if what I'm doing is right. I don't know if it's, you know, if I'm really getting any virtue. I don't know how much, if any. You know what I'm saying? And I have this concept that the negativity that I'm creating for myself is much higher than whatever virtue it is. So the joy, I mean, you know what I mean? Because we talk about virtue in such a way that it's confusing, and I don't know if, you know, it's just a confusing concept, and it's... Maybe you can explain it a little more. Maybe you could,
I think when you're being good, you know it, and you feel it. It's a natural thing. You will, if you go to the hospital and help someone, you feel it. When you come out the door, you feel something different. And that's all I'm saying. At the beginning, it's quite easy. And rejoicing, which is so foreign to our minds, to be happy about someone else's success, or at least my mind, and to, you know, take joy in other people's goodness, whatever they have, the people all around you do have, it just immediately starts to make you happier.
How do you rejoice? Like you help someone and you want to feel good, but you don't want to go too far and feel like I'm the greatest person in the world.
You have to watch pride. If it can upset you later, if they got mad at you for what you did for them, then I think that would be a sign that you have the wrong attitude. That you might have pride.
Yeah, but you can be arrogant about it and people think you're great. You know what I'm saying?
Okay. That's true too. Okay. After you've prepared yourself.
Isn't that the point of dedicating? I mean, if you do something good and then you give it away for the benefit of others, it undermines pride.
Have taken the form. So you can only enter the diamond path if you've made your mind a worthy vessel. What does that mean?
Practice.
Get the Lam Rim down, at least the outline, at least understand the roadmap pretty well. It's called Golchepa in Tibetan. Golchepa means a rough outline in your mind. You know, a rough concept of the whole structure of the thing. And then you have taken the four empowerments in a pure form. You must have taken the four empowerments. Those are four essential elements of every tantric initiation. And I can't tell you. But it must be a pure tantra. It must have been passed down by pure lineage, and it should not have been corrupted by any corrupt practices during that lineage. So the lineage has to be pure.
How do you know that?
Very difficult. Especially before you start. I think that's a difficult question. Before you start, it's very hard to tell. I think you might be somewhat able to judge it by the quality of the open teachings that the person gives you before he gives you the initiation. That's about the only way you can establish it. After you have been admitted, after you've been given the initiation, then you can ask questions about, well, can you tell me, you know, where did this come from? Who are the teachers who gave this initiation? Where did this lineage come from? Can you show me the texts in the Kangyur Dengyur in the canon? You know, where this lineage came from, or this teaching that you're giving, can you really show me what the sources are? And a teacher should be able to say, yeah, here, and point it out to you. This came from the Buddha himself. And that I haven't added anything, or my teacher didn't add anything, we didn't change anything, and it hasn't been corrupted by some strange practices. So,
excuse me, Michael, yeah. How was it determined in Tibet a long time ago who would get an initiation? Who would take one?
They used to be very, 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 there was called Shelshepa, which means from the mouth of the Lama. And students were initiated in groups of one or two. And there are certain famous students who never were initiated by the Lama, you'd be surprised at the list. You know, you might be surprised that so and so was never granted a certain initiation from this root Lama.
Even though they perhaps
wanted
it.
They lived together for 20 years or something, and the Lama never felt comfortable. But in the old days, the most important parts of Tantra were shel shepa. I mean, they were restricted to being taught to groups of one or two students at a time by the Lama privately. And that's still part of the tradition.
Yeah. Is doing the preliminary practices part of making your mind a pure vessel? How does that fit in? Is that sort of the full making your mind?
You mean the ones we talked about?
The nyunjo. Nyunjo.
Nyunjo. Yeah, that helps.
Mainly
knowing the Lamrim is what it takes. Like mainly having got a good grounding in the Lamrim.
I thought you couldn't really succeed unless you had done all the Nyunjo, completed the Nyunjo practices.
And mainly in our tradition, that refers to doing the tantric retreats, which we'll talk about.
Okay,
next page, 11. You have to take an initiation to get the vow and the pledges. Okay. What's the difference between a pledge and a vow? Pledge is defined as something that you shouldn't give up. A vow is more like a restraint. The word in Tibetan means a restraint. You know, not to undertake a bad deed. So I guess a pledge is more something that you've pledged to do. And a vow is more something that you pledge not to do. And you're not allowed to know them or to get them until you take the initiation. You have to take the initiation to be granted those pledges and vows.
What's the reason for not knowing what that is beforehand?
In some kinds of vows, you are taught beforehand. Like of the three vows, tantric, bodhisattva, and God morality, some of them you're required to study them beforehand. But not in tantric, they're secret. So you can't, not allowed to tell you them until you take it.
Why is that? Why can't they tell you?
I think they would reveal. You have to have permission. I can't tell you.
I was taught that was because if you requested initiation, you should be so willing or so desirous of having the initiation that it wouldn't enter, it shouldn't enter into your mind what the commitment is, that you shouldn't weigh it in that way, like, well, I'll only take it if I can get away with like 100,000.
I haven't, I don't know about that. Okay. It sounds good. I haven't seen that explanation. Okay. There's a lot of things I haven't seen. Okay. You must keep your vows pure. And I think it's correct to say, if things are as they seem, that many people who've taken initiations can't even tell you what vows they took, much less keep them. And if you don't keep them, nothing will happen. At the best, nothing will happen. And if you do keep them, you get quite wonderful results. So you have to know them well. Rinpoche's proposal for the summer was, you get the preliminary initiation, then he's going to teach the Bodhisattva vows and the tantric vows, and then after that you get the high initiation, which is Vajrayogini in August. So that schedule is like that, which is the only way he could do it. It's a very rare opportunity. He's very old now. We had a class last night, and we realized that May 93 was the last class we had of that with him. Mm-hmm. So it was almost a year. Without a class in that subject that he was teaching. You know, he was teaching one book and he didn't get to the next page until 10 months later. So a very rare opportunity. He's the youngest you can be and have finished the Tantric College in Tibet. The year he graduated was the year they ran away. Just after he graduated, they ran. Mm-hmm. So he's the youngest you can be, and he was supposed to become the head of the Tantric College. He was like the provost or something like that. So So he's very qualified to give it correctly. All right. C, on page 11, is how to meditate upon the two levels of tantra once you've kept your pledges and vows pure. So there are two steps in tantric practice, two levels of practice, and they don't work until you are keeping your vows well and your pledges well. And that's what I was saying the other day. I don't know if it's with you guys, but in a way, tantra is secret for the reason that you will never see anything if you don't keep your vows. It's self-secret, self-protecting secret thing. You know, you will never see it if you don't keep your vows well. Okay. And if you do keep your vows well, and you didn't want to see it, you still would see it. Mm-hmm. So
but why you still, like, you stop yourself many times tonight? Oh, I cannot say this. Oh, I cannot say that, if that's the case.
I'm talking about the physical words also we're not allowed to mention. It's just a very, very wonderful path. It's a very, very special path. According to Buddhism, you can achieve Buddhahood in this life before you die if you practice it properly. And but properly is just do it right and don't fool around with all this tantra.
Becoming a monk or not.
Why don't you don't? This was designed for people who didn't want to become. it has no difference. There's no distinction whether you've become a monk or not. You can practice tantra. Tantra is for everyone. Anyone can practice tantra if they're qualified by knowing lama.
Can you say what the two levels are? G and C.
Can you say what a vow is? Or not the definition of a vow, but the vows that they're talking about? Is that?
Well, a vow means that you swear that you won't do certain things anymore.
Is that a film?
That's the first 14. Okay. Anyway, like that, you have to pledge not to do certain things. All right. If you keep those vows well, then you can achieve the two stages of time. I could describe them to you. It would probably be nice to. I'm looking forward to it someday. But not right now. I can't. And again, if we were pure in the morality, even at the level we have now, you might have deep understanding of what these are talking about already. Okay, so that's my tantra advertisement for the initiations this summer. I don't know if Rinpoche will be in a position to do that again, so I think it would be good to do it if you can. But we do have to ask him properly. So maybe, you know, when I get back from India, we'll see how we, you know, maybe I'll call you or something and see if you want to be on a list. And he asked me to give him a list of people that he would consider that list.
Has something gone out in the mail about this?
Yes,
somebody
got it out.
A mailing went out. If you didn't get it, it means you're not on the mailing list. So you might want to.
But I have it if anyone wants to look at it.
But I'd still like to get you on the mailing list in case something changes. Okay. So if you didn't get one, come up to me afterwards.
Right on Tuesday.
Name out.
It's from the Washington.
Then the next to last verse in the practice is just praying that the things that could stop you won't stop you, and praying that you can collect all the causes that you need to succeed. Faith, do you want to turn on the water? Do you want to crack open the door? You guys hot? And then the last verse of the text is a prayer that you meet lamas in all your future lives. And You know, I've said before, I try to imagine life without my teacher, but I can't think about it. You know, I think it would be very terrible. So I can't even imagine what it would have been like to not to have stayed with him. So you know, you have to pray that you get that can happen again.
Michael, is the spiritual friend your root lama?
It doesn't have to be, but it's mainly referring to your root. I think there's this middle way between people who say they have 50 lamas, which I doubt, and then people who say they only have one lama, which is good. But I think I've not been able in 20 years to establish what I thought was a close relationship with more than three or four lamas. So that's just my own experience. Maybe some people are more capable to handle more than that. I haven't been.
Well, if you have a root lama, when you have three or four, or is there all equal?
I think there's one root lama, normally. They might all be the emanation of him by the time you figure them out. But I think at our level...
What if you've chosen a root lama and somebody comes on along that you feel closer affinity to?
That's a good question. Let me ask Rinpoche. I'd like to.
You could have more than one lama with him. Like some lamas bring some things in your life, teach you some things.
Excuse me.
Is something wrong?
You know what? Excuse me. It's really my fault. But this is your review class. I'm feeling really uncertain. It's 20 past something.
Yeah. It's okay. We'll get there. We'll review everything.
Sure.
So, do you have, could you have more than one root lama?
No, that's not what I mean, but you could have a close relationship with more than one. And
oh, sure.
And each one could do something very important.
Yeah, sure. We're talking about the one that is, it's like the lady of your life.
Well, it's also possible that, you know, your root lama may not be the lama that you spend most of your time studying.
That's absolutely
well.
Possible.
Yeah.
Yeah. Absolutely possible.
Yeah. She's wet.
Okay. So that's the text. And I repeat, if you're not getting up in the morning, or if you're a night owl, before, you know, there are people, and I don't, when I say get up in the morning, I mean whenever is your time. The morning's not too great for me personally, actually. But you must get up and do this. Otherwise, this whole class, this whole course, this whole building, everything is a failure. You know, if you're not getting up, and here's the ammunition for your life. You know, that's the whole roadmap. When I was translating, I thought, gee, that just covers everything I ever heard of. You know. It really does. There won't be anything that we ever cover that you won't be able to fit into one of these outlines. In fact, I might ask you sometimes, you know, hey, what category does that go in? You say, oh, number 3. I don't mean memorize the numbers, but the sequence is logical, by the way. Yeah, obviously. You know, first you find a teacher, then you try to stay out of the hell, and then you try to stay out of animals, and then you try to go up, and then you try to help other people. It's logical, and you'll see the logic of it. So it's a very precious thing. It's a very valuable thing. So meditate on it.
Yeah. Does memorizing it so well and having it in your mind so well is part of the point of that, so that when you die and you lose most of your control and your consciousness, that it's ingrained in your mind that the elements of it will be there? Is that part of this?
It's path? A little part of it, but I'll tell you what Kabunka would have said. He'd say, you know, don't talk to me about your future life. You're going to practice tantra and finish it all now. This is not going to be relevant to you. It's not going to apply to you.
Okay. Presuming you practice tantra correctly. I mean,
well, you are.
You don't
going to.
Calendar, I mean,
you're going to.
Did he come back?
Huh?
Did he come back?
By we say by wish. He's in his third reincarnation now. He's a good friend. He'll probably teach here soon in a few years when he's ready.
Thank you. You're not going to ask questions, I know you're
thinking. I'm not going to, you know, the last course was so tough that I was pretty wimpy about the final exam question.
We'll never know, will we? I've given up asking.
I did start to grade them today, because today I had some free time. And I'm going to do it on the plane. You actually quite good. I've done a couple of them. Vicari got like a 99999.
That's
me.
Is that you?
Oh.
Oh, now you know.
Right.
Thank you. So, I'll go over. It's obviously important that you know the whole structure of what we did.
Structure.
You tell me. The whole structure of the whole course that we just did. What was the whole structure? That's not the structure. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, the outline.
Is that all?
Do you want number two?
Yeah, there's the environment.
Posture.
By the way, and I'll start to make some clarifications here. It's not just physical environment, as you know. Right? So I would say rather environment. I introduced it that way in the beginning, and then I corrected myself. The first part was physical place, but the rest weren't, were they? They were somewhere with different kinds of environmental factors, like your mental environment, your morality, stuff like that. So I wouldn't say physical environment, I'd say environment.
B is environment, not physical environment?
Right. So it was more like, so it's preliminaries? Physical environment. Environment. physical posture. Environment.
Mental
posture. Diane came up with the word mental technique, which I kind of like. By the way, a lot of people came up with good words. Gustavo in the other class, the patchy meditation is called mending the holes, which I like. That's actually what it is. You know, it's
physical posture.
Mental technique. Physical posture is number three. Mental technique is number four.
Object was called.
And what was number five?
What
was inside of each one of those?
Four points.
Inside of preliminary, there was what?
Seven ingredients.
But before that?
Preparation.
Six preliminaries. Yeah, that was the first of the six. There were the six preliminaries. Mm-hmm. And then inside the six preliminaries, inside number five, in fact,
Is there something else to preparation other than the six preliminaries?
No.
That's it.
Well, yeah, the seven ingredients inside of the pit, which is a little confusing. Right? And again, I asked Rinpoche to clarify. Some people said to me, well, the last ingredient is what?
Dedication.
And the sixth preliminary, which comes after the seventh ingredient. Blessing. So some people said to me, well, it seems to me like dedication should be the last thing you do. And I asked Rinpoche, and he said, exactly right. He said, really, dedicate. He said, that's a good point, and in practice, that's the way you should do it. I mean, the last thing should be the dedication. Do I want you to change the order in the text? No. But in your practice, you know, the last thing you're going to get up and do before you get up is put all that virtue in the bank. You know? So yeah, that was a good point someone made. That's about all I can think of.
Why do you need to? When the last step is requesting blessings.
Requesting blessings. Well, you can
dedicate merit before you request blessings.
Well, like requesting blessing is a great virtue also, so you can break it down. So that was the preliminaries. The second was what?
Environment.
Yeah, the environment. What were they? What were those?
Water and air and not a lot of oil around it.
Six conditions.
The first was the place.
Yeah,
these
were place.
It was a good place.
If you want.
And that had five characteristics itself. But I wouldn't expect you to get in such detail.
Few needs.
Easy satisfied.
Give up
doing too many things.
This is part of those five that we don't have to.
And then morality.
Wasn't there another giving up?
No, yeah.
Giving up harming other people.
Lots of worldly desires.
Giving up too many. Yeah.
Doing too many things.
There was giving up too many things, and then there was
not thinking harm.
And then morality from not harming.
And then there was another giving up of too many thoughts, of bad thoughts.
Yeah.
Getting rid of desire. Stupid desire.
Yeah. And don't forget, by the way, I mean, I don't expect you to get in this kind of detail, but don't forget when I said then to get rid of desire, it includes the idea of the senses. You know, there are two kinds of desire objects in Buddhism. One is like chocolate or girls or whatever. The other one is
girls?
A guy, okay? The other is just the objects of the senses. Without regard to, you know, it just means to withdraw from them. So this has both connotations in Tibetan. You know, ultimately, when you're in deep meditation, forget withdrawing from chocolate. That's the gross one. But the subtle one is you've got to withdraw from all your senses, all the objects of the senses. What I mean is the objects of desires. Objects of desire is sometimes a code word for the objects of the senses, period. You know, sights, sounds, smells, tastes, and touches.
What about you said you also have to get rid of anything permanent in your life?
Anything permanent?
Okay. Yeah. You said sense desires for any.
Oh, well, that's the main point that he emphasized there was that none of them last.
That's not your fault.
They're just silly. Their nature is stupid. Career or. Or most relationships, or a good dinner, or looking pretty, or handsome, or all not desirable. Okay. What came after that? What was the third one?
Posture.
Yeah, posture. So that would be what? How many parts to that?
Eight.
Yeah, seven. Sometimes seven. If you count what?
Eight.
Yeah, those are pretty easy. After that, we got to
mental technique.
We discussed the number of problems and the number of corrections. How many problems?
Five.
Yeah. Which are debated these yesterday. We got to debate out 5 years ago. It's such a nice day. We're out on the lawn. It's great.
Laziness.
Meaning what? I mean, I hope you never. I hope you never teach it to your students as dryly. As laziness, you know, and I hope they never understand it as laziness. Mm-hmm. It's as laziness, you know, and I hope they never understand it as laziness. Mm-hmm. It's being tucked in bed warm, and the alarm goes off, and mm-hmm. says, "Maybe not today." And I do it. I know it very well. So it's really not wanting to do it. It's not having the heart to do it. Not feeling like it. So the word is laziness, but I don't like the word too much. And we debated it the other day in our debate with the monks. It came up. Yes. Okay, second problem?
Losing the object.
Oh, let's talk about the antidotes in first. How you don't really feel like
attraction at one point.
Yeah, see what's nice about it. The main thing, as I said many times, you cannot get rid of this suffering if you don't perceive emptiness directly. If you do perceive emptiness directly, if you're able to pull that off in this life, and there's no reason why not, you're very, very, you're flirting with it. You know, you have a proper teachings, you have accurate teachings, you're right in there close to Nagarjuna, Chandrakirti. There's no reason why in this life, without the proper training, you shouldn't be able to see emptiness directly. If you do, you're on your way out, period. No more than seven lives. Impossible. It's even given as an example of impossibility in the scriptures. And you can do it. You can see Buddhas. You can see your future lives. You will see it directly. You can do it. So, but you can't do it if you're not practicing meditation daily. And it doesn't mean like 3-4 hours. It just means a good half hour, a good 45 minutes. But so often and so well looking out for Qinghua. Okay, that subtle dullness, which is the opium that ruins your life's meditation. Okay? You know, if you get into a Qinghua track, you can keep that up for years, and you'll never know what happened. afterwards. The big danger. So watch out for that. So anyway, that won't happen to you and cannot happen to you if you're not meditating every day. You cannot proceed into this. It will never happen. If you are meditating daily, it will happen someday. So that's the selling point. That's attraction. Second one?
Yeah.
By the way, in a worldly sense, if all you care about is your career or blah, 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 still, shamatha is a great way to get ahead. You can focus it on anything and do it pretty damn well. Okay, so, what was the second one?
One.
That's one. Just kidding. What was the third one? Meaning working to get it. And number four?
Practice
these, meaning that untranslatable pliancy, agility. Rinpoche calls it gymnastics. Gymnastic ability. Anyway. Okay, that's obviously not, by the way, the exceptional practice piece that is comes in the definition of what? Shamatha and Vipassana. It's not the one mentioned there, obviously. It's obviously a lower level. Okay. All right. Number two, problem number two.
You lose the object.
Which is called
forgetting
instructions. And I hope when you teach your students, you don't just repeat forgetting the instructions and then the lineage breaks. They never figure out that it meant losing the object. It means losing the object. Then what happens?
Remembering
recollection. Now, a lot of people have good questions. I've studied it more. Is it to recollect what you were doing when you find out you lost the object? Or is it an awareness that you don't lose the object in the first place? I explained it the first way. The scriptures I've read since then are emphasizing more the second way.
Doesn't it depend on which stage you are, as to the level of
it would,
and
it would.
To how it's functioning?
It could have both functions, but mainly it's watching out to see whether or not you are losing the object. And when we debated it yesterday, we just came out with it has to be all three, really. It's functioning as a kind of awareness that you don't lose the object. It's functioning as you begin to lose the object, and it functions after you lose the object to bring you back to the object. So it really has three functions. But the main one is described as not losing the object in the first place. So how then does it differ from shishin, from watchfulness, which comes later?
That catches you.
Watchfulness is catching dullness or agitation.
Once you already have the
recollection is catching whether or not you've lost the object completely, all right? That's a distinction between the two. And you need both. Both have to be going on. Okay, problem number three.
Agitation and dullness.
Yeah. And correction?
Watchfulness.
Catching it. Does that stop agitation and dullness? No. That's why the next step is called. The next problem is not taking action. And the fix for that is taking action. And the fix for taking too much action is not taking action. And leaving it alone. But I didn't tell you the last fault there, the last problem, which we call taking action, right? The antidote for that we call
not taking action.
And the texts sometimes say tam yom su shakma, which means leave it alone. Okay, that's easy. And then you move up through the, let me see, do you know those nine things?
So do we have to know all that stuff about fixation without clarity?
You have to know
what's
on the quizzes.
Well, if somebody asked you what was the difference between gross and subtle dullness, you'd say gross dullness has
fixation
but no clarity. Subtle dullness has
fixation
but no intensity. And if somebody says to you, if your students say to you, what does clarity mean? And if you say, the object gets real clear. yeah.
Wrong.
Yeah, please means mellow. You know, it means that the alertness mellow is bright. It's a quality of the subject and not of the object. That's difficult to remember. Clarity so often seems to imply of the object. But this is like when you say, yeah, I'm real clear on that.
Is intensity a degree, a greater degree of clarity? Is that what?
Yeah, it's always described as cell chain, which means the intensity of the clarity. Good question. Okay. There was a bad question on one of the quizzes. It said, how do you know that the fourth problem has occurred? Some people got it wrong. What is the fourth problem?
Not taking action.
How do you know when it's occurred? That question wasn't very good. It's really, how do you know when something's occurred that you should be taking action about? And you can answer watchfulness. Okay. Because watchfulness actually occurred before you didn't take action. Okay. I would say that the nine states of meditation are pretty important to know. And everyone got them very good on the quiz. I was amazed. It made me feel bad. I should have asked you more questions on the earlier quizzes. Because everybody did them really good. And I could never recite those.
Is that why, like, after that, we started getting so many more questions on the homework?
I realized I had to do
that. That was the day you left them on the board, wasn't it?
Yeah. Name three different types of meditation. Oh, no. You have to know the outline pretty well, okay? And that's another reason why I printed it out. Anything on the outline that came in the quizzes, you should review. And that's why I did that whole handout. So now it's real clear to you how it works on the outline. So I won't give you anything on the outline that you didn't have on your quizzes.
You mean you won't give us anything on our exams?
This final exam comes only from the quizzes. So if you know all the parts of the outline that are ever appear in any of the quizzes, you're okay. But you better know.
So it's like you mean to say, like, here, fill in, like, write an outline? That's the quiz?
Yeah, here's the whole outline, and you can even, you know, put a mark on the ones that come in the quizzes and concentrate on those. Okay. If someone were to ask you the four laws of karma, don't blindly put karma is certain as the first one. Try to explain it a little, because it ain't what it sounds like, is it? It doesn't mean that you definitely get a result. It means what?
It means that if you
get
good actions result in positive.
The content is true. Certainty is in the content. Good leads to good and bad leads to bad. That's what it means to be certain. Sometimes I think they should never call it that anyway in the first place.
Well, then what's two and three?
You're tricking me. This reminds me of a tragic story where all the ministers of the king got together and said they bet that one of them bet that he could make the king bark like a dog. And they all tried different ways, but the guy who won was the guy who said, I have a dog, and he goes, meow, meow. And he says, that's not what a dog does. He says, well, what does a dog do? He goes, whoa, whoa. You're trying to get me to state the other three. Check your quiz.
Yeah,
that's okay.
Oh, I know what the other three
are. I think the two different. Since the whole class was about shamatha, really, and since so many people misunderstand vipassana, I would say it's very useful to know the correct descriptions of those two. Right?
Yeah, that definition is twisted.
Well, a technically correct definition is normally pretty twisted because it has to cover every possible debate that ever came up in the last 1,000 years.
It's very clumsy, though.
Yeah. It is clumsy. Yeah. It is clumsy in Tibetan also. Mm. But it has to be that way to be precise. Probably we could have worded it better, because I didn't translate it before I got here. But
Michael, why do you have like adjectives like exceptional bliss rather than just bliss?
Ariel asked me that today, and I looked it up in the computer, and the point about exceptional bliss is that your mind and your body are totally capable of doing whatever you demand of them. In meditation, it means that you're able to order your body to sit there for 4 or 5 hours without moving, and it feels great. And then the mental part is that you can stay fixed on the object for about 3 hours without a single distraction. And as I said, there's this process where that ability straightens out the psychic wings, and that straightening of the psychic wings causes bodily a sensation of bodily bliss. And then that becomes something that makes you happy, and then you end up with that's the definition and the description of how exceptional bliss occurs.
Exceptional.
That's all I have.
I don't want to take time if you're continuing to review, but
no, that's it. That's all the review.
What is psychic bliss? What exactly does that mean?
I think it's what, you know, generally Buddhism discourages, real Buddhism, as you've been getting a good taste of it, discourages these vague mystical things, you know.
You mean like channeling them?
Because they're vague mystical things, you know. But inside, it has to do with the energy on which thoughts travel. And you could maybe compare it to nerves, but they're not the physical nerves in your body.
It's like they're more refined nerves.
They're Michael? Like you can't see them.
Like meridians?
Yeah, I was going to say, isn't the closest?
I don't know like, what a meridian is.
It's like the meridians in acupuncture, sort of. I think from what I've read.
But I think it's much more
technical.
I don't think it's that. I actually don't think it's.
Is it like the central channel?
I don't think it's the
same. I've heard it compared to the current in electricity. It's not the actual channels that the current travels on, but it's the energy. The sort of pattern that the energy assumes.
You can study it. There are books about it. And Rinpoche has taught those books, and they've been translated. And when you've had the proper initiation, I think you could go into more detail. I'm not kidding. You know, there are good descriptions of it, and very detailed descriptions of it. But right now, you can say it's a kind of energy or force in the body on which the related to your physical body. Which is sort of where the thoughts and the physical body meet. And the thoughts are carried along those, along by those wings. And that's all I can say. But when you are ready to study the whole subject, there's whole books written about it, and they're very precise and very clear, and you can try to do the practices that are required, and you'll get some result. It's very, very bad to try to do any of that before you get formal teaching. And many people have had terrible experiences because of that.
Is it like Kundalini?
I don't know Kundalini as much. You know. But you'll know when the time comes. Any other questions? No.
Thank you for teaching.
Oh, my pleasure. My good luck. Otherwise, I'd be watching TV. but I say, be happy, you know, be glad. Very rare opportunity that there's a joke in Tibetan that when there's a teacher around, there ain't no students, and when there's students already, the teacher's gone already. So it's very, very good virtue, and what we're doing is very, very, very excellent. And I'm very also happy to see how everyone is helping each other, except on the homie, but I'm not. No, but I love to see, it's a pleasure to see, I mean, Dharma, the result of Dharma should be at least that we should be good to each other. And I think, I see it, you know, I see that everyone's being good to each other. That's a good sign. They call it the stink of Dharma. in the place. it's the fragrance of dharma. When people are getting warm with each other and people come out and then they're better people. Because just to know everything and not be a better person is a pretty miserable state. And we are in danger of becoming like that. The more you learn, the more you better be getting dharma sweet. Because if you're not, then nothing can change you later. You've used up all the things that could possibly have changed you. So you got to be careful then. He just asked me, Tim asked me to give you Rinpoche's name. And Rinpoche is a very overused word, but it basically means a lama who's reached the state where he will be reincarnated as a lama in his next life. And Ken means short for Kenbo, which means an abbot. And sometimes people nowadays are giving the word Kenbo to somebody with three monks in their monastery. I guess it is. But in our tradition, it's reserved for someone who's been a head of one of the major six monasteries. And Geshe is someone who's finished, nowadays it means someone who has finished the entire 18 or 20 year course and passed in the monastery. Although there's a lot of people using the word Geshe now who are not real Geshes in our tradition. Lobsang is his ordination name. Losam Tachin. Losam means pure mind, and it comes from the Tsongkhapa's first name. And Tachin means gone to the end, reached the end. His root lama was Kyabje Tujan Rinpoche, who was the teacher of the present Dalai Lama, one of the two tutors. And he was the main disciple of Pabongka. And Rinpoche also studied under Pabongka directly for many years as a young man. Pabongka passed away in the 40s. He's from Serame Monastery. He did attempt to college unless you were a Thangpa Geshe, which means one of the top two or three in your class. So there would only be about a handful of those each year.
Why were they so much more strict? Why do we have such a difference now? And
It's still a tradition that you don't get into the Tantric colleges even now unless you're a Harappa Geshe. You're not considered an automatic entrant unless you are a Harappa Geshe. But you can apply and you might be accepted if you have other reasons to be there. And there are monks who just go and learn the rituals and never go to their Geshe studies also. There's a certain class of monk who can do that.
But even originally,
like Namgyal Master, much of their studies are like that.
But even originally,
they become ritual masters. Yeah.
The Buddha didn't want, originally, like you said, there were many people who didn't learn the Tantra, who were students of the Buddha. What was the reasoning for that? Why, what was it? Was it a fear of people not being ready, or was it, what was the...
If you don't follow it properly, you can achieve Buddhahood in this life. If you don't follow it properly, at the worst, you can have some terrible results, some big disaster. But you don't have to worry about that. You really don't have to worry. You have Rinpoche, you are in a lineage which is pure, and it's being followed nicely, properly, correctly, without corruptions. And you're getting the proper training, and you don't have to worry about it. You just have to worry about trying to put it into practice. But you don't have to worry about the thing being dirty or you can't do it or something like that. It won't be like that. But you have to use good sense and follow it properly. And you will get the right results. And that's great. There's no problem. And then he asked me, Tim asked me where Rinpoche is right now. It's a Mongolian temple.
I have a question. Rinpoche, I always thought that meant where we incarnated.
It can mean that also.
Oh, it's on the precious gem.
It does mean, it means a precious thing, and it can mean gem. There's seven kinds of Rinpoche: gold, silver, and then gemstones.
Well, how do you tell if it's and it's listed out that they have been reincarnated from the...
If they say Rinpoche, it either means, normally it means that they are already a reincarnated lama. Mm-hmm. And in some rare cases, someone has disqualified now, and he'll be a reincarnated in the future. The Dalai Lama gives a chakda, some kind of...
But there's no real way to tell that much ask.
Right. And they're not supposed to say sometimes. So.
Is this lineage involved with the FPMT then?
We are the same lineage, yeah. They're from the second best monastery. Usually beat that. According to I'll tell you, Sarah J is really damn great Tibetans. Great tradition of studies. Among all the great monasteries, they're studying very well. Okay.
I have a question.
One more, last question.
All right. Rinpoche chooses who's to be initiated, or you've chosen him to be initiated, by the light.
Oh, first you have to request. He's not allowed to give it to you unless you ask. And I think what I'll do is ask Margie to call up people and see if they want me to put their name down. Then I have to go to him and request. And maybe a group of us should do it. Normally you present some flowers and very respectfully ask. It's kind of gotten convoluted in the West because we don't know enough to ask at the right time. Mm-hmm. And so certain teachers will say, well, I think it's time for you to ask. And we need it. I didn't know when to ask him, and I told him that. So please let me know when to ask you. You know? So I think it'll turn out very well, though. You're very well. You're in a good, pure tradition, and you will get the right results. And that's all. That's the way it goes. All right.
Sashi Mukhi Lushin Atokam Lira Vinci Kine Yampadi Sane Shindu Mikte Govadi Drukun Nanda Shima Chupasho Idam Guru Ratnamada Kamne
So Michael, please return and teach.
Oh yeah.
Not die.
What is that? Yes. What day is the teaching for?
Yeah,
24.
Is there a class tomorrow? Sorry. Yeah, there is.
And that's a Sunday.
Some point in the next few weeks, I'd like to get a team and go out and paint Rinpoche's garage for him. He likes that kind of stuff. So I'll let you know.
When is the next course?
The next course will be on Pramanavartika, which is the root text on the study of perception and logic. What, you know, how do you know what you see is true? You know, what is truth? How do you know when something is true? Meaning perception or fact? And that's important. It's a mind-only school. Very important. And we're going to study the chapter, which is not taught in the West much, because no one gets to it unless you go to the winter debates for about 6 years. And almost nobody gets through 6 years of winter debates. It's
a great class.
In my class, two people got through to the fifth year. So it's...
What happens to them?
It's hard. That chapter is devoted to proving that... that there's a past lives and future lives, and proving how the world was made and what creates human life, and then proving that it's possible to bring the mind to a state of reflection. And that's devoted to those things.
And that came from an ancient dispute between the Buddhists and a Hindu school called the Gyanpembas, who said that it was impossible, and that they said that there was no past life, and that your mind starts when you're conceived, and your mind dies when your body dies, and the world was made by this big guy who has all the power to make the world, and that, and ideas like that. And so this ancient debate that sounds familiar, you know. It's very, very good, very, very useful. And they said that you could not perfect the human mind, that the human mind is basically defective, you could never become pure. So then the Buddhists try to prove it. And they're very good debates. We did this debate in front of a Catholic girls' school last week. And yesterday, this big group called me up and said, we'd like to come to Buddhist classes.
Wow.
So it was nice. I mean, if you do it properly, it's... we didn't convince anybody or ourselves, but we proved that it's possible.
So what did you do? You just decided to walk onto their lawn and do this debate?
No, they came to the temple for a visit, for a lecture. Oh. So I just called the other monks and said, let's debate. Let's debate whether or not there's a past life. Can you prove it to me? And they tried, and they tried for like 2 hours.
And
they did it in Tibetan and I translated. And I said, that's not a proof, you know, and you got to find us a good proof. And we went on and on and on, and finally we got to a point where everyone in the room agreed that, well, it's probable that there were past lives, and that's enough. You know? So it's great. So that's my, I guess it will do... next course, probably late June to early August. Starting late June.
Alphabet class?
I think we'll still do an alphabet class in April, maybe once a week. Light class, just to learn how to draw the letters and stuff. And I want to teach it to a few people like Tupin Ernst and Serge, and then they'll teach it from then on. After that, they'll be the teachers of that. If you want to come to that, that's good. It's a way to learn in 2 nights how to pronounce Tibetan perfectly. And most people never do.
How will we find out about the class?
How
will we find out when the class is?
I think I'll ask Margie to call around.
Which is great if you're on our list.
If you think you're not, if you suspect you're not on the list, meaning if you didn't get that thing from Washington, D.C. about the classes, about the initiations thing, come up and put your name on it. Okay, good night. Thank you.
Good night. Thank you.
Sasi Bhakti Jashimeta Sham Rira Vinci Nyende Yampati Sange Shindu Mithe Uwagi Jogo Nanda Shimla
This is the end of Class 11. You have been listening to Applied Meditation with Geshe Michael Roach, presented by the Asian Classics Institute. The Asian Classics Institute is dedicated to preserving the pure teachings and practice of Buddhism. For a listing of other topics available, write to the Asian Classics Institute, P.O. Box 20373, New York, New York, 10009, or call 212-475-7752.